This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
The Women's Hoop Show, a podcast hosted by me, Jordan Robinson, brings you fresh women's basketball voices and breakdowns every week. I'll be joined by hoop experts all year long. Find the Women's Hoop Show on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Rich Zeoli Show podcast is sponsored by Mike Venaria Jr. with Osperity Private Wealth.
Hi, I'm Mike Venaria Jr., wealth management specialist. Make your retirement dreams a reality by creating your retirement plan today. Call me at 856-252-0107.
I'm telling you, there's scandals in California every single day, it seems, with Gavin Newsom as he tries to rehabilitate his image. Breaking news on Secret Service whistleblowers, and I don't know about you, but I was hoping for some more answers in the JFK files. Welcome back to the show. Glad you're here today. 855-839-1210 on X at Rich Zeoli. It's a busy day. It is a Wednesday. We are getting through the week, and we're very happy to welcome back to the show our friend Susan Crabtree. We tried yesterday. We had a little technical difficulty, but hopefully today works out well. She, of course, is the author of the brand new must-read book, Fool's Gold, The Radicals, Con Artists, and Traitors Who Killed the California Dream and Now Threaten Us All. It is out, and you should get it. And Susan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Rich, and for caring about my book and plugging it like that. It's available on Amazon. You know, we're not. We have to get the word out, according to my publisher tells me. Don't hold back.
Got to do it. Though, look, I'm actually flying out to California next month. I got invited to do the PragerU Book Club. And so I'm going to be there with Michael Knowles, and I'm looking forward to it. And I love California. I'm excited. But, I mean, it's a state that's been ruined by the left and their policies. And it's just such a damn shame what they've done to that place. And so much of it is because of their progressive, kooky ideology, but also for personal greed, as you outlined. And there's an exclusive story you have about Field of Schemes, Gavin Newsom's baseball college admission deception. Let's expose this guy before he runs for president and then, you know, God forbid, wins, given what he's done to California. So tell us about the Field of Schemes.
This is a window into who Gavin Newsom really is. He has been talking about his baseball career, that he had pulled himself up from his cleats, basically his lace cleats. But yet, you know, it's the story just breaks down when you take a hard look at it. So a lot of he went to Santa Clara University. He likes to talk about how he would not have gotten into a 4-year university because he had a 960 on his SATs and not very good grades. So the baseball is the thing that got him there because he was such a great athlete. Well, I had Santa Clara University varsity baseball players contacting me saying, that's just not true. They don't remember him being on the team at all. He was not on the official roster for the team. So I started looking into this, and it turns out I talked to the assistant coach, Mike Cummings, at the time, who did actually recruit him, but he recruited him because a wealthy alumni, William Connolly, who was tight with Newsom's father, basically told him he had to. And he didn't get this full scholarship like he likes to talk about. He got a partial scholarship, $500, and he played on the JV team, and it was basically only scrimmages. The thing that he leaves out, the big thing he leaves out about the story, is that Jerry Brown, gave him a letter of recommendation. Now, he's the former governor of California, and his father was also governor of California, and Newsom's grandfather helped his father get elected, Pat Brown. So if you can figure out all those ties, there's also money ties involved, too. But basically, he did not that letter accompanied his college admission application. And so he doesn't mention that when he talks about this baseball, his baseball career at Santa Clara. And even the UCLA coach, the current coach of UCLA's baseball team, he doesn't remember him being on the team at all. And he was there too. So, you know, it's a fable in San Francisco. It even was announced at a Giants game that he was drafted by the Texas Rangers. That's how much this has blown up over the years. And it just doesn't hold up when you take a close look at it.
I mean, the guy is just such a fraud. He really is. He's such a fraud. And it infuriates me, too, because you looking at Gavin Newsom as the kind of guy who would lie about being like a man's man, as he talks about toxic masculinity with Tim Walz on his podcast. In fact, let's play that clip, Matt, if we could. This is Gavin Newsom. Can we play the audio? Can we do that?
Play the video.
Oh, we play the video too? Okay. This is Gavin Newsom and the Minnesota doofus Tim Walz, scores vice presidential candidate, talking about toxic masculinity. And take a listen here.
1 second. Justin's loading it up right now. Here it is.
It's a natural reaction. I think it's one of the reasons we're losing so many men. And again, it's multi-ethnic. It's not just white men. We're losing them. We're losing them to these guys online. We're losing them to people that I'm bringing on this podcast as well. That's why I brought
these are bad guys, though. These are bad guys.
But they exist, and we could deny they exist. They exist. Not only do they exist, they persist, and they're actually influencing young kids every single day.
How do we push some of those guys back under a rock?
I think we have to first understand what their motivations are. I think we have to understand what they're actually doing.
And you don't think that's racism and misogyny?
I think there's a lot of that, but I don't think it's exclusively that. When you talk to a guy like Steve Bannon, he reminded me a little bit of my grandfather when he talks about working folks, and he talks about how we hollowed out the industrial core of this country. But I understand that. But so we can dismiss the notion of election denialism. We could completely dismiss.
All right, that's enough. We get the point. Susan, I don't believe a word of what Gavin Newsom's doing here. I think that if he didn't have his eyes on the White House and the climate hadn't changed, he'd be saying exactly what Tim Walz is saying right there.
Oh, exactly. You know, these are the whole idea of toxic masculinity. This is part of his wife's gender justice films that she actually, that's what her side hustle. She does have an office that taxpayers pay for in the governor's office and a staff, but she also makes a lot of money off of these gender justice films. And one of them is it's called Misrepresentation. And if you watch it, it's all about how, we're being, these ideas of manhood and femininity are being imposed on them from the outside. It doesn't spring from within you as a natural concept of being a girl or a boy. It's pretty disturbing when you take a look, and she's getting her films funded by corporations with business before the governor's office, including PG&E, which is responsible, the utility, which is responsible for the deadliest wildfire in California history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean, this is what's happening.
And your book exposes that fool's gold, which I think is really, really important here. Let me also bring up something you tweeted out a few hours ago. Mafia Don behavior from Newsom as he tries to position himself as the 2028 Democratic frontrunner. You can follow Susan on X at Susan Crabtree. Gavin Newsom is sending a burner cell phones to CEOs across the state and shutting down reporters asking about it. And these are just the burner phones we know about. What is this guy, Walter White? What's going on here?
Well, the most disturbing thing about this is that it's actually being funded. He's sending them to them, but it's being funded by this group called California Protocol Foundation, which is a dark money group. So you don't get to know, they're a nonprofit, but you don't get to know who their donors are. And then they're funding things like his trip to China. Mm-hmm. And so was it really when we exposed his ties to the CCP, all of his business ties, the fact that he's trying to get his wine into China and trademarked it, and was pouring his wine for CCP officials in Shanghai in a shishi restaurant. I mean, this is so interesting to me that they actually paid for these burner phones that can't be traced. They're not, you don't have to have your information that you called these CEOs publicly disclosed because there's open records laws in California. But if you use these burner phones, there's no record of it. You can't get it if you're a journalist. He's been telling journalists since the wildfires happened, he's been denying their requests for his phone records, who he talked to in Karen Bass's office as Los Angeles mayor. It's super secretive. But yet he wrote a book back when he was lieutenant governor about how government should be so transparent and how he was, that was his goal with his political rise, that he was going to make California one of the most transparent states in the country. And then he does things like give burner phones out, so to hide his calls to companies and whoever else. These are just the burner phones that we know about so far. And this is kind of what.
Go ahead.
I was just saying, this is like what mafia dons do and what drug lords do. You know, they hand out burner phones to their guys and get them into, even sneak them into prisons. I mean, this is how they operate. But why is the governor of California that's, you know, running for president via podcast, why is he doing this?
Now, if I were to buy some of his wine, Plump Jack Winery is the name of it, I could buy two bottles of the 2021 Plump Jack Reserve Cabernet Sauvignon from Oakville for the bargain price of $720 for two bottles of wine. That's insane, number one. But number two, I guess it's not insane for China to buy it. And that's the whole thing, right? Because you said that the market there for California wine is exploding. I think anybody who spends that kind of money on wine is an idiot. I really do, because you can get great wines for $30, $40 a bottle. I think you're an idiot if you spend that much money on wine. That's just me personally. But the whole thing with his wine and China and that connection, which you pointed out, I really want people to understand that. So could you remind us of that, please?
Yes. So while he was setting up a nonprofit called China SF to get Chinese companies to come into California, and he did so to the tune of $5 billion, he says that's what he was responsible for, getting more than 100 Chinese companies into the Bay Area. He was trademarking his wines in China, and he actually had a tasting where he personally poured the wine for people there, and a lot of them were CCP officials. And we have this all documented. It's all public information because he likes to promote the fact that he was in China doing this. But we had to use, you know, definitely press releases from decades ago we dug up the showing this. But yeah, we have, it's all of our everything in our book. There's no, everyone's on the record. We have named people that are whistleblowers that came forward, and we have public documents that are open source. So, you know, he's tried to smear us, but he can't respond substantively to us because it's all there. Some of these Chinese companies that he brought were actually, one of them at least was convicted of bribing some of the San Francisco officials that Gavin Newsom himself appointed for clearing their illegally, putting them at the front of the line for their permit processing. I mean, it just goes on and on. We have it to buy the book, Fool's Gold. It's available on Amazon to get all of the gory details. But you know, it was eye-opening for us. And that's just one part of the book.
No doubt about it. Susan Crabtree, let's move on to, you are one of the best investigative reporters out there, I think, which is why Fool's Gold is such a must read. Because really, there's a lot of lessons we can learn from what they did to destroy California and the corruption. Let's talk about the Secret Service, the whistleblowers. The Secret Service, you tweeted this out. Secret Service exclusive agents allege retaliation after Biden grandchild incident. The United States Secret Service is not an Uber service. So you have some whistleblowers from the Secret Service who came forward. What did they tell you?
Well, this is part of a series I'm going to be doing on retaliation against Secret Service whistleblowers. I've been hearing that they're actually targeting, if they talk to me, they're going to have their security clearances pulled. So we'll have another story tomorrow. But this particular story involves Maisie Biden, who is one of Hunter Biden's daughters. And she was in 2021 rolling around the city, going to nightclubs with a few of her friends. And the Secret Service agent was driving her. And then one of her friends was aggressively telling the agent, not in a very respectful manner, from what I understand from the lawsuit where I found this information, hey, drop us off at this place. Can you drop us by this place? And the Secret Service turned to the person and said, I am not a Uber driver. The Secret Service is not an Uber driver. We don't provide that service. We get the person, the protectee that we're supposed to be guarding. We get them to their final destination. End of story. Well, I guess Maisie Biden, she actually thanked the Secret Service agent from what the lawsuit says at the end of the drive and said she apologized for her friend's behavior. But then somehow something happened and that agent was called on the carpet for this by his superior and said, you need to write that up in a memo. And by the way, don't say anything negative about Maisie Biden or her friend's behavior that night when you write this up. And he believes, the agent, according to the lawsuit, that he was passed over for several positions in part because of this incident with Maisie Biden, that basically she told on him.
That's ridiculous. That really is ridiculous. I'm so sorry for those agents that have to deal with that. But I'm glad you're reporting about it. And you said there's another series you're going to be doing. So when can we hear that from you, Susan Crabtree?
I'm trying to get it done. I was thinking today, but here I am talking to you. I have to get back to make sure it's all lined up correctly. But tomorrow, by tomorrow, I'll have it in.
Great.
It's unbelievable.
This well, I don't mean to pressure you. I'm not your publisher.
I have self pressure, but it's about insider threats. This agent was trying to warn the Secret Service top brass of insider threats, and they believe they were retaliated for trying to say, hey, we need to be more vigilant about mental health in the Secret Service.
Well, I don't blame them. I mean, after everything that's happened in that agency with the push for DEI and all the other nonsense, talk about toxic masculinity, where a lot of men were told that they couldn't be on assignment because the agency was pushing DEI initiatives. I imagine morale was very, very low. Any new developments on your investigation into the events that occurred in Butler?
Oh, I have so many things. I'm working on a book proposal, which lays out, there's a lot of things I haven't reported on. We can talk about some of the problems there's trans Secret Service agents with the DEI. And I'm not seeing anything from Sean Curran yet that is reversing these issues. You know, there's a trans agent that I've written about who is a biological woman, but wants to be addressed as a man and go to the men's locker room. But this person is trying to see if they can still have the training requirements of a woman. So this is ongoing, and I've asked the Secret Service about it, and they're not, you know, disclosing. They say they cite privacy laws that they can't talk about individual Secret Service agents or trainees. I'm working on some stories about the DEI policies that have really lowered the standards in the Secret Service. And it's not just DEI; it's lowering all types of standards, whether it's, you know, how many drugs you've done in your life, the type of training, you know, hurdles that you have to overcome to qualify for an agent, your accuracy on at the range. It's all part and parcel of why the Secret Service is having problems. And there's so much more to report on that. I would say stay tuned to my X account at Susan Crabtree for that. I try to tell people when I'm going to have something to put turn notifications on. And this week I'm going to be dropping that story about insider threat and the retaliation.
All right, good. Before I let you go, the movie industry fascinates me. And I know that during COVID, they took a big hit, but a lot of the people, there was a story I remember of a woman who did catering for movie studios. And, you know, the draconian rules that Gavin Newsom put in place during COVID were some of the most egregious in the country. And that industry took a big hit. A lot of film companies, TV production companies left California. They moved to Austin, Texas. That's kind of become like a new hub of this. But Gavin Newsom's policies in weaponizing government during COVID, again, trying to rewrite history, much like Andrew Cuomo is trying to rewrite history and all this. But I would say here on the East Coast, because we weren't, you know, following it, we had our own problems with Murphy and with Tom Wolf at the time. And you know, certainly everybody was talking about Cuomo at the time because he wouldn't shut up. You know, he was on TV every single day. Gretchen Whitmer, of course, her husband, you know, getting special treatment with his boat. But Newsom, in my mind, has to go down as one of the biggest tyrants exercising his executive power during COVID. Am I wrong on that point?
No, you're absolutely right. I had to live through it myself. And he was shutting down churches and was really hurting the church membership while he was keeping Hollywood carve-outs open for Hollywood and also for the liquor stores. He was telling people that it was so absurd what was going on in California. Some of the beaches, the state beaches would be closed, but the city beaches would be open. So everybody would rush onto the one that was open, whereas you just, and so that it was defined the whole reason to be separated by 6 feet because you were pushing together, but you look across the way and that beach is completely empty. And he was ticketing surfers for being out on their surfboards during early COVID. And it was ridiculous. But one of the worst things he did was he let up to 70,000 prisoners out during COVID because he's trying to close down some prisons during his tenure. And he did it under false pretenses. We had a whistleblower come forward to us who worked in the prisons and was the liaison to Governor Newsom's office. And Newsom was telling the California citizens that they were doing this because, you know, there was going to be a death spiral like the nursing homes in the prisons. So he had to let them out. For some reason, it didn't make much sense to me at the time. But guess what? That was even a lie because the outside rates of COVID infection and deaths were higher on the outside. So it was something like 400 times more likely that they would die if you let them out than if you kept them in the prison, according to the person keeping track of the infection rates who talked to us. So it's just that was part and parcel. I mean, he locked down people, he forced them out of their jobs, but then the unemployment system was so crazy that they couldn't get the checks to the people that were unemployed. But yet, you know, people were there were so much fraud going on. There was $30 billion worth of fraud of people stealing the money. I mean, it just was chaos during COVID in California.
Well, read the book Fool's Gold. It's a must read. We got to get the truth out there and expose it before this guy winds up becoming president. So this is the book to get out there to your friends. Fool's Gold, the radicals, con artists, and traitors who killed the California dream and now threaten us all. And follow Susan for these breaking updates on the Secret Service whistleblowers at Susan Crabtree. Thank you, my friend.
Absolutely, Rich. Thanks so much for having me. And thanks for your concern about California.
It's going to Rich Cioli Show.
Yes, he will. No doubt about it. Okay, as we continue along the show today, a lot to get to. The JFK files, they are out. Did we learn anything new? Let's find out. We'll talk about that with our buddy Gerald Posner. I want to tell you, as we talk about all things in life, we talk about our homes and making our homes look beautiful. That's where Emmons comes in, Emmons Roofing and Siding. You got to reach out to Emmons. They're the best. And they're offering each and every one of my listeners a 10% off inflation relief discount. So what are you waiting for? Make your home look beautiful this spring and get your home ready to withstand the elements with the best in the business, siding, roofing, windows, and more, and a 10% off inflation relief discount for each and every one of my listeners. What makes Emmons different is the quality of their work. They do an incredible job of making sure the job is done right, done on time, done on budget, and that you're satisfied with the work. Because Matt and Stephanie understand that. They pride themselves on that. And that's why you will love the Emmons difference. And the reason why I've been using them for over 10 years in two different homes. They first did our roof in the old home. We have a lifetime warranty on that roof. It's transferable. Great job. Then they replaced the windows, doors in our new home. They've replaced doors, and we have another project that we're ready to go with them as well. So just go with the company that I trust, and that's Emmons. EmmonsRoofing.com, EmmonsRoofing.com.
The Rich Cioli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
Bo's wife winds up snapping at him. That's pretty funny. We'll share that out of audio with you. And the JFK files are obviously out. Have we learned anything new? Is anyone surprised here? Let's welcome to the show. And Justin, you can pull him up for me. Our buddy Gerald Posner. He is an investigative author and writer and all around great guy who exposes the craziness of everything from Big Pharma to the deep state. He's an award-winning investigative journalist. And he is the author of the book, Case Closed, Lee Harvey Oswald and the Assassination of JFK. So, Gerald Posner, happy file release day. I know we've been through this before, but happy file release day.
Yeah, we're finally here, Rich. It's unbelievable. You know, it's a big document dump. It is like 80,000 pages. And, of course, they don't tell you when they release it what's new and what's not from the stuff that had been redacted. So you sort of have to go through every document and compare it to something that was released a year ago to see what's new. It's a torturous process. But all of us who are into the JFK assassination are going through it as steadily as we can with as little sleep as possible.
Now, you also put this into ChatGPT. You asked Grok to help. You also did a couple of these things. I saw that on your Twitter feed, at Gerald Posner. Were any of them helpful in going through these 80,000 documents?
You know, I'm disappointed because I was really hoping that AI would be at the point where you would be able, somebody who's running one of these AI systems, Musk with Grok, could feed into it all of the material that was released yesterday from the National Archives, and then also all of the material that was released just a year ago or 2 years ago and 5 years ago. It would just take a little processing power. And then once it's in AI, you could actually say, tell me what's new in these. Highlight everything that's been released now that wasn't released before. And then you could have a pretty fast determination. So AI isn't saving us the time yet, which is pretty disappointing. I was hoping I'd live long enough not only to see the JFK files released, but to see AI give me a hand, but no such luck.
Now, I think the thing, and I have not read 80,000 files, but I've read a couple stories from people who've delved into them, was that Schlesinger was warning. Schlesinger, am I saying that name right? Do I have the right guy?
Yeah, Schlesinger, right?
Schlesinger, right. Was really warning about the CIA and the CIA's power back then, and was very, very concerned about it, even back then in the 1960s, which, you know, it's still something that we're dealing with today. So I found that to be very eye-opening.
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, that memo is out in its entirety, and Schlesinger sort of saying, you know, be careful of the CIA. There's no question that they should be worried about it. And people were always wondering, by the way, is that why, you know, maybe Kennedy was killed because he was thinking of breaking up the CIA? I get that. I've always said that there were people inside the CIA, I'm sure, who couldn't stand Kennedy's guts. They didn't think he was enough of a war hawk. They didn't like him, without any doubt about that. But the memo itself is in news. I mean, what these couple of Washington Post reporters back in 1975, when they were covering all the misdeeds of the CIA before the Church Committee, had covered that memo up, and then it just never got out again. There were parts of it that were redacted. So I think Schlesinger was actually on the money. He was right in warning about the CIA and that there could be these rogue elements inside of it. I just don't think in the end that there's any evidence that would tie any of that into the Kennedy assassination. But I understand that the warning itself was a good one.
Well, I think, you know, the problem with this, and it's a problem that you and I have talked about in the past, is that if there really was a smoking gun, it would have probably been destroyed a long time ago. I mean, they're not just going to let it sit in the National Archives. If there were very powerful forces in our government, they're not going to leave a paper trail. And that's always the problem with these things. But we did learn some new things about Lee Harvey Oswald, right, in these files, in the sense of his contacts with Cuba, his contacts with Russia. There are more details about Lee Harvey Oswald that have come out.
Yeah, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, I think that's interesting because one of the things is, to me, always, first of all, you're absolutely right about if there was a grand conspiracy, an Oliver Stone style conspiracy, just imagine that would mean that essentially some part of the deep state pulled off a virtually perfect crime back in 1963. They fooled investigators like me who came along and think that he is just Oswald. And then the only mistake they made was they sent the documents that reveal the entire conspiracy over to the National Archives, where they've been sitting for all these years, to be released as part of a declassification thing. Of course, they would have been destroyed, or they were long ago gone. So, you know, people waiting for the big discovery today, it just, even if they were right, it wouldn't make sense it would be there. The thing is, we do learn more about Oswald, and I think that's critical because, for me, you only really understand what happened in the assassination if you understand the person that I think carried out the shooting that day. And Oswald was a just turned 24-year-old kid who had a very unusual past, without any doubt. But, you know, he was unique, somewhat unstable. The Russians knew he was unstable because he had defected to the Soviet Union and they had a psychiatric file on him. They described him 6 weeks before the assassination when he showed up in Mexico City. One of the KGB agents described him as psychotic. I don't know if he was psychotic, but he was certainly an unusual character without any question. The real question I've always had is, why didn't the CIA know he was as unhinged as that and warn the FBI about him?
Well, yeah, that okay, so then this is where it gets a little tricky here, which is this idea that, you know, if there was a kind of a grand conspiracy, so to speak, if they knew Oswald was dangerous, why was he allowed to be in Dallas that day? Why was he allowed to be, you know, in the school book deposit? Why weren't there eyes on him? I mean, all those questions come out. And they, I guess it kind of feeds the theory that, well, maybe Oswald might have been part of the deep state. And that's why, even if he was the assassin,
yeah,
and if he did act alone, maybe he did so at the behest of the deep state.
So my take on that is, I mean, two things. First of all, the great thing is that Oswald, if he had been part of the deep state and he was the shooter, though, I can guarantee you one thing, and that is he would never have left the depository alive. He would have been shot mm-hmm. by some dirty cop or somebody who would have been a hero, right, as he was leaving the building. They would, and remember, Oswald left the front of the building. He didn't, like, leave through some secret exit or whatever else. He walked out the front of the Texas School Book Depository after having shot Kennedy and to go back to his rooming house to pick up his pistol. So he did run into a cop a minute and a half after, and the foreman of the school depository said, oh, that's a guy who works here, so they let him pass. So they would never run the risk that Oswald could have spilled the beans on the killing of the president of the United States. People say, oh, he was silenced 2 days later by Jack Ruby. Guarantee you that if it had been a deep state plot, he would have been silenced at the moment he stepped out of the depository. But the other part of that that's interesting is, was the assassination preventable? Same thing as 9/11. You know, when the CIA did not tell the FBI about two terrorists that had come in from Malaysia into California and then later ended up in the Saudi terrorists who ended up in the 9/11 planes that day. I think that there was information that the CIA had picked up about Oswald in Mexico City when he was trying to get to Cuba just 6 weeks before the Kennedy assassination, and they didn't pass it on to the Bureau. The FBI had an open file on Oswald, but they would have made it a priority. And then when he got his job at the book depository, that would have been flagged. So could Kennedy have been saved? Yes, potentially. I mean, all the cards would have had to break in the right way. I understand looking back, it's easy to know what we should have done, but it is possible.
I mean, if a guy who has these contacts with the Soviet Union and Cuba and is nuts and he gets a job at the book depository, don't you think you reroute the motorcade around that, or you make sure the guy's not there that day, or you know what I mean? Because, I mean,
right. So the great news, though, Rich, is he gets the job at the depository just a few weeks before Kennedy's there. They haven't set the motorcade route yet. So they set the motorcade route after that. They go down Main Street because they want Kennedy's tour through Dallas to be the main thing. That's it. Then they do this little jig-jag over that takes them through Dealey's Plaza where the book depository is, and they have to do a turn. Then they head out to the Stemmons Freeway to get to the trademark where Kennedy's going to give a speech. Now, what's interesting is the only part of the Secret Service protocol that was violated that day is the turn in front of the book depository, because they're not supposed to make a turn like greater than 90 degrees. It slows the motorcade up too much. That turn was sharper than that, and they had to make that right in front of the depository. They still did it. So there are conspiracy theorists who think that the Secret Service was somehow in on it because they're the ones who planned the motorcade route together with the Dallas Police Department. I think it was just a series of bad decisions, one on top of the other, that ended up putting a fellow who wanted to be in the history books for an assassination. He tried to kill a U.S. Army general a few months earlier, who he thought was going to be the next Hitler, this guy called Edwin Walker, a retired Army general who had to run for the governorship of Texas, and he had missed Walker, and suddenly had a chance to kill Kennedy. It was the biggest cog into the machinery of government he could throw, and for Oswald, it was a dream come true.
And Gerald Posner's with me, the author of Case Closed. I guess, you know, the counter to that could be, you would say, all right, but maybe much like Butler, you have people within government who, it's easy to blame government incompetence because government's totally incompetent. But all it takes is one person to be able to just influence a meeting as to where a motorcade turns, or influence a meeting of where the perimeter is going to be at a presidential rally, and then circumstances work out. And then you have to wonder, I mean, boy, that's some real big luck right there that Lee Harvey Oswald could be at that moment at that right time and that they can make that decision, right?
Understood. And then, of course, but let's assume for a second that the motorcade was pre-planned. Somebody says, let's put it in front of the book depository because we're going to try to get this guy Oswald up there to take some shots at the president. Everything also has to break right inside the depository. And what I mean by that, inside the place that he works at, Oswald is working with other co-workers on the sixth floor where eventually he takes the shots at Kennedy. They break for lunch at noon. All of them go downstairs except for Oswald. One of them comes back up because he forgot something. If they'd gone down to the lunchroom and come back up to the sixth floor, Oswald's not, it's not a suicide mission. He's not like an Islamic terrorist. So he's not going to take out his gun and start shooting at them. He's left alone, which is the break that he needs. And then he misses one shot. He wounds Kennedy on another shot, so it's not successful. The only shot that actually works for him is the lucky, what I call a lucky third shot, when the motorcade has slowed to a crawl of 5 or 6 miles an hour because the driver of the limousine, the oldest member of the security detail, this 52-year-old William Greer, has turned around and looked back at the president after the second shot to see what's going on. So Oswald gets the straight-on shot. It looks like it's 25 yards away in a four-power scope that he has. And he almost misses Kennedy. It hits him high in the right rear portion of the head, an inch and a quarter higher, and he misses. And it's a failed assassination. We know with Butler, look at an inch over, and Trump, or with Reagan, with Hinckley, an inch over into the heart, and Reagan would be dead. That's the difference sometimes in these assassinations between being failed or not. So it's everything just has to break correctly.
Now, The other question that I was thinking about, though, in terms of this is and I never really put much stock into the whole idea that the mafia might have been involved in this and they might have, you know, tried to cut the head off the snake by, you know, getting rid of Robert F. Kennedy by doing this. But, you know, obviously there's a lot of people that question whether or not Jack Ruby taking out Lee Harvey Oswald,
right,
and he was in his involvement with the New Orleans mafia and everything else. And this was done to save Jackie Kennedy at trial and everything like this. I mean, you know, his death was also very suspicious. I think the problem with this whole assassination is that from the Warren Commission and Alan Dulles, and I think we can all agree, Dulles is like, if there's a monument for the deep state, it's Alan Dulles. I mean, literally, the guy, right?
Yeah, so absolutely.
You have the Warren Commission. You have a lot of people who feel that the Warren Commission, including there was a, you know, Philadelphia lawyer who used to argue all the time about Arlen Specter and the magic bullet theory, and the Warren Commission was rigged, and then how do we get from there to the 1978 House Select Subcommittee on the assassination, where they rule that there might have been a likely conspiracy? What new evidence did they encounter then? Because, you know, if you watch the movie JFK, obviously there's that great scene with Donald Sutherland, Mr. X, where he talks about, you know, the motorcade never would have went around there. And then it ends with them saying, after Jim Garrison loses in court, that, you know, the House ruled in 1978 that there was a probable conspiracy.
Right.
So what information did they use at that time to make that determination? Yeah.
Well, first of all, when you mentioned Ruby, Ruby's the reason that I used to think it was a conspiracy, because when I started investigating the case in the early 90s to write the book, I thought, you know, that looks like a silencing, like a mob silencing. They kill the guy who's accused of being the assassin 2 days later in police custody, a guy who looks like he's out of central casting for the mafia. You got to be kidding. Of course it's a conspiracy. And then when I did the book, I found out, no, I believe actually that Ruby did it on his own as well, but I understand why people immediately think Oswald never had his day in court, evidence never presented. And then you get the Select Committee 15 years later, who they do a great job of debunking a lot of the conspiracies, including Garrison's trial that had come up over the years. The problem was at the very end, there was a Dallas police dicta belt that they found, and they thought, oh, wow, if we listen to this dicta belt, maybe on that we'll hear the sounds, because there are two channels recording everything that's taking place with the police. Maybe we'll hear the sounds of the assassination. And it turns out that one of the Dallas police officers at the end of a motorcycle said, hey, my intercom was stuck in the on position. So they said, maybe you, McLean, he's the policeman, you might have recorded the assassination. They had two sound guys from New York listen to it, these experts. You don't hear anything on the tape but a bell ringing. And they said, hey, we see these four like supersonic impulses, and we think those are bullets. So the Select Committee closed its work. They ran out of money, and they said 95% certainty of four shots, which means it's a conspiracy. That was the headline that everybody remembers. And then 4 years later, the National Academy of Sciences, this big panel, Ramsey, they did the whole thing. They went through all these studies, and they actually found out that the tape didn't record the assassination. The four impulses the sound experts thought were shots took place a minute away from the assassination. It was a major unfurling of the whole thing. But that made page 35 of the newspaper. Everyone remembers just the finding, 95% certainty of conspiracy.
And Gerald Posner, tell us about, there's a man who's in the document dump is really, we've heard his name a lot. His name is Gary Underhill, and or John Garrett Underhill. Who is this guy? And he wound up, as I see from one of the documents, the day after the assassination, Gary Underhill left Washington in a hurry. Late in the evening, he showed up at the home of some friends in New Jersey. He was very agitated. A small clique within the CIA was responsible for the assassination, he confided, and he was afraid for his life and possibly would have to leave the country. Less than 6 months later, Underhill was found shot to death in his Washington apartment. The coroner ruled it a suicide. Well, tell us more about that guy.
Yeah, no, so it's fantastic. So Underhill's actually a story that's been around for a while. It was in a book by James Di Eugenio, a fellow who claims that Underhill knew the entire thing. So out years ago, he's considered a big source. He wasn't actually a CIA officer. He served with military intelligence during World War II, and then he had worked on some projects afterwards. But this is a big story. And it's, although it's been out before and nobody's paid much attention to it, I love Rich the Way, because people who aren't in the weeds on the JFK assassination, it makes perfect sense to me. They look at the new files. They don't know what's new and what's not new. They find a story like Underhill and they think, oh my God. And I see the headlines everywhere from Newsweek to the Daily Mail to wherever else. CIA agent says his own agency, you know, was involved in the case. And my take on Underhill has always been the same way before this dump, which is, okay, that's interesting. So you get a guy who shows up who says the agency was involved. So what is it besides your intuition? What's the evidence? What do you know beyond that that makes it something? I mean, LBJ believed to his dying day that Castro and the Cubans were involved. You know, you can be president of the United States and still be wrong about who was behind the assassination. So I understand that people can think different things. He could have been a full CIA agent, Underhill, which he wasn't, and still thought the agency was involved. And then I say, okay, then tell me what's the evidence and let me have something to work with. But Underhill never had that, but he just had this great report secondhand of what he thought after the assassination. Then he died. The official cause of death is suicide. And the minute you say that, everybody immediately thinks, oh, sure, he was murdered. So right. Underhill's story has been revived and it's going to get plenty of headlines, I'm sure.
What about the question that was asked by a number of people, which is there anything regarding Oswald having either gunpowder residue on him or anything that would have physical evidence tying him to that rifle and demonstrating that he had fired a gun that day? Has anything come out in these documents about that?
No, as a matter of fact, there's nothing in terms of, you know, people are looking for things like the bullets and, you know, are we going to find out anything more about the single bullet? Might there be something like that? It will be anything about gunpowder residue or items like that that were done? No. And I don't think, you know, that's one of the things I do think that people expect you're going to find more here than you probably will find, unfortunately, because you're not going to get the what I call answers to the physical assassination as much as you're going to get answers about what was happening in the Cold War and the intelligence people over a period of time.
So then that probably answers the question that my buddy Don Povia sent me on X. And I'll read you his question, Gerald Posner, since you are the guy who has studied this case. If there's nothing new in these JFK files, why did it take so long for them to be declassified and released? And again, this is a conversation that we have had, you and I have had in the past. This is not the first time files have been released regarding the Kennedy assassination. So what is it really about? What are they? They're obviously hiding something. So what are they hiding?
Yeah, I mean, that's the part as I continue to go through these, Rich, that I'm boiling at is I keep asking myself on so many of these files, why was this one hidden? Why was this one sealed? Why did they hold this one back? I'm reading about names of CIA stations that they've literally blanked out that we were working with Romanian intelligence, or they moved an operation to a different city and they didn't want that substation known. it's preposterous that for 60 years, some of these files were held back as if our enemies didn't know what was going on. And it really is a testament to, you know, you want to call it the secret state, the deep bureaucracy, whatever else, why Musk and Trump are existential threats to the bureaucracy, because they wouldn't tolerate this type of, it becomes a cover-up. And it's not a cover-up of a murder, which I don't think it's a cover-up of a murder. It's a cover-up of their own ineptitude. They're covering their own behind, their reputations, mm-hmm. and they're hanging it on the hat of confidentiality and not exposing sources or means of gathering information. I think it's disgraceful that these files have been held back this long.
Yeah, it's the reason why it fuels such distrust. It really does. And you know, the last thing I'll say before I let you go, and I really appreciate you being on the show today, and you should go to Gerald Posner, posner.com, P-O-S-N-E-R. His books are great, from Hitler's Children, God's Bankers, Mengele, Case Closed about the Kennedy assassination, and his most recent book on pharma, Greed, Lies, and Greed's Lies and the Poisoning of America, which is obviously going to be a very hot topic again. But it's Lyndon Johnson. I mean, you know, Roger Stone, who worked for Richard Nixon,
right,
who has, you know, been an advisor, is a very controversial public figure, convinced that Johnson knew of it, was aware of it, wanted it to happen, and that it was that's really the reason why this has been such a cover up is because of Lyndon Johnson. Is there anything in these documents? And I know it's 80,000. You haven't had a chance to digest them all. I haven't. Nobody has. Anything in there at all that would confirm Roger Stone's speculation?
Roger would say that he doesn't need anything in the documents to confirm his speculation because he's already proven it. I debated Roger a number of years ago in Miami. Roger's fantastic. He's unmatched in terms of it. There are two things. First of all, I've always said to Roger that what he says about Johnson, in every presidential assassination, you know, we always say in every crime drama, who's that person who has the most to gain? You're inheriting something. Is there money, sure, or whatever else? The person who has the most to gain in every presidential assassination is the vice president, because you're moving up to the top job. Yep. You know, you go from a heartbeat away to taking over the job. So in that sense, and then if you have the Kennedys giving the vice presidential nod to Johnson. They didn't really like him that much. They thought he'd say no. And then he said yes and surprised them. It happens in Texas. So all of that. And I say that this is Roger Stone. Remember, Roger loved Nixon. He has the Nixon tattoo on his back. This is Roger's ultimate revenge, which is to continue to pummel LBJ's historical legacy so that it becomes absolutely garbage and that LBJ is thought of as the murderer behind the Kennedy assassination. It's the ultimate tribute to the Nixon administration. And Roger is a provocateur. He's great. He's wrong on the assassination, but I must tell you that I do really like him in the sense that you cannot but be bemused whenever you talk to Roger, and he will tell you that my book is not even worth being a doorstop somewhere, but I still like him.
Well, maybe we could host the next debate between Roger Stone and Gerald Posner on this show after both of you have had a chance to go through the 80,000 documents. Before I let you go, I'll just say one more thing, and that is that I always appreciate your great nature about this and your humor about this, and of course your willingness to be wrong. So if you were to discover something in these 80,000 files and the book is case closed, would you then have to write a book called Case Reopened, or how would you handle that?
Wrong. Imagine, you know, the document that both of us don't think exists, some document about the conspiracy and everything else that's in there. Let's say that document was in there. You'd have to be a fool, okay, to say, oh, well, you know what? I'm going to stick to my story no matter what. There's nothing that's going to convince me otherwise. Of course you have to be open to it. I thought the mob was involved in the assassination. Then I followed what I believe was the credible evidence to conclude it was Oswald alone. If something changes my mind after 32 years, I'll be the first to say I'm stunned, but I'll do it.
All right. Well, listen, my friends, stay tuned. Keep us posted, as always, and follow Gerald Posner. And if you have not, read the book, Case Closed, because it's an excellent book. Whether you believe it was a conspiracy or not, it's still a damn good book to read and open your mind up to new possibilities. Gerald Posner, thank you, my friend.
Thanks, Rich. Great to talk to you, as always. Thanks.
The Rich Cioli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
Well, like I said, a lot to go through, and who knows? Maybe by next week we'll have some more on this. I don't know. I think, you know, the biggest thing clearly is that the My opinion, the CIA, the biggest, if nothing else, it confirms what we've all known, which is that the CIA, even in the 1960s, was dangerous and weaponized against the American people. And the deep state was very powerful. And I think the Kennedy assassination would then lead to the deep state, obviously, seizing on that to assume even more and more power against the American people. I think that's something we can all agree on based on this document dump. But hey, more to come on this, no doubt about it. Listen, my buddy, Dr. Mike Veneria, is a great dentist, great friend, and the master of dental implants. What you need to do is reach out to him today by going to VeneriaDental.com, V-A-N-A-R-I-A, VeneriaDental.com, with two locations to serve you in Cinnaminson and Woodbury. He's the man, and he'll give you the smile of your dreams. He really understands, first and foremost, what it means for you to get great dental care, because that's what it comes down to. It really does. It comes down to you getting the best smile possible. And that's what he's all about. That's why he's trusted. And for over 10 years, 10 consecutive years, he's been named a master of dental implants among his peers for that reason. So have you reached out to Dr. Mike yet for your dental implant consultation? Because if not, you better do it. You got nothing to lose, right? You got a beautiful smile to gain, and so you should do it, all right? Just go to VeneriaDental.com, V-A-N-A-R-I-A, VeneriaDental.com. Dr. Mike Veneria, VeneriaDental.com.
The Rich Cioli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.